From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The NPR correspondent Margot Adler has read something approaching 300 vampire novels over the last few years. She describes it as an obsession she didn't quite understand at first. She knew it had something to do with the fact that her husband was dying of cancer. It occurred to her at some point that vampire stories were about mortality, but later it seemed they were about something broader, a reflection of all of our concerns and our fears, and throughout human history there's always been something to be afraid of or worried about. These days, she says, a relationship with the Earth is one of the things that's driving the vampire books and movies that are so popular. The title of her book sums it up best, Vampires Are Us. Margot Adler will join us to talk about it after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the NPR correspondent Margot Adler is our guest to talk about vampires. Adler is a reporter who's been working in radio for decades now. She also happens to be a practicing Wiccan and pagan, so it gives her a unique perspective on spirituality. And it turns out vampire stories have something to say about spirituality. They also have something to say about mortality. When Margot Adler's husband was diagnosed with terminal cancer, it led her to read a kind of obsession with vampire novels, and she read dozens of them over time. She believes they're not just about spirituality or mortality. They have a lot to say about us. They're metaphors, reflections of our fears, our sense of guilt about our relationship with the planet as well. The title of the book sums it up pretty nicely, Vampires Are Us, Understanding Our Love Affair with the Immortal Dark Side. And Margot Adler is joining us today from member station KGNU, which is in Boulder, Colorado. She's attending a conference there. Margot Adler has served as an NPR correspondent for more than three decades now. She reports on NPR's flagship programs, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Weekend Edition, all of those programs. And Margot Adler, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, okay, so I want to start, if it's okay, with the spirituality part, and not just the vampire spirituality part, but your own personal story, because you do write a bit about this, as I said, practicing Wiccan and pagan since 1972, and I wanted to get a sense of when this started, because you write a bit about this interest, this love of ritual, you say, this love of Greek goddesses went back to your childhood.
Well, I went to this extraordinary school called City and Country in Greenwich Village, and I came from a very secular, you know, family. There wasn't much religion going on. And when I was 10 years old, we were studying the Middle Ages in fifth grade, in the equivalent of fifth grade. And on the morning of May 1st, my mother had to take me to school at 4 in the morning, and we went in a teacher's car to some teacher's home with lots of gardens and flowers, and we picked flowers as the sun rose, and we had learned all these medieval May Day carols, and we came back to the school, and we started strewing these flowers from classroom to classroom and singing, you know, all these medieval carols, and then we danced around the maypole, and I think way down deep, I became a ritual junkie for life right. as a result of that experience. And I just loved it. I didn't, you know, I couldn't really put a word on it or what it meant, but I just loved it. And then when you have to realize that I'm 67 years old. So when this was all happening, it was the 50s. Right. And so when I studied Greece, and we studied Greece for a whole year, ancient Greece, when I was in the equivalent of seventh grade, what were the 12-year-olds, essentially, I just thought Artemis and Athena were incredible images of incredible beings. And I didn't want to worship them. I think way down I wanted to be them. And right. I think you have to realize that in 1970, you know, in 1957 or, you know, when this was, or 56 or whatever, there weren't a lot of images of powerful women. And so Artemis and Athena were pretty much as good as it got. And then later in life, you know, when I went to college and later, you know, I sort of put all that away in a drawer and sort of said, oh, well, you know, that's not, you know, what is that? You know, you can't worship the Greek gods or pretend to be them unless you want to end up in a mental hospital. Yeah. And then I got very involved in the environmental movement sort of around. I started reading the environmental writers. I started reading, you know, Thoreau and I started reading, you know, all kinds of different. Yeah, Muir. Yeah. And particularly I was in California and so forth. And I remember coming across that fabulous Muir quote, you know, when you pick up anything by itself, you find it hitched to everything else in the universe. Yeah. And I started reading all this stuff and I realized on some deep level that I, again, couldn't really articulate that there was a spiritual dimension to the ecology movement, that it wasn't just sort of a political thing. We should, you know, we should have clean water, we should have clean air, that there was something sort of a sort of ecstatic relationship to the cosmos that was going on. It, certainly when you read Muir or you read Thoreau or any of that, there's something going on there that's not just political. And you know, so I was looking for what I might call an ecological religion, and I was kind of trying to figure out where that was. And I sort of stumbled across in the 70s, I kind of stumbled across what, you know, the earth religion pagan movement. Yeah. And that's how it, you know, I suddenly realized people were attempting to revive an earth-based spirituality. And I kind of felt, wow, I think I'll go there.
Well, you heard this tape of a ritual recorded in England. And there's a lovely story you tell in the book about that, which it really had this, it seems like this really profound effect on you.
Well, what happened was I was, you know, I didn't know how you, you know, enter the pagan movement, you know. I was looking, you know, I started looking in the Village Voice for something, right. You know. I started looking, and of course you can find all kinds of things that are totally wrongheaded, you know, like the Church of Satan or something. You know, you can't, you know, things that are not what you're looking for. And I finally finally went to England and I saw an address and I subscribed to this magazine called The Waxing Moon. And I subscribed for it for a while and these things would come to my house, you know, like 8 times a year. And I didn't understand half of what they were saying. And one day a letter came in the mail and it was from some people who described themselves as witches in Essex, England. And they said, you know, we have tapes of our rituals. Well, you know, for £2 or something, we'll sell. It was, you know, it was a come on. Yeah. And I wrote back and said, I don't have any money, but I do a radio show on Pacifica. So they sent me this tape. And I didn't have the right tape recorder. And for months, I was going around saying, ha ha, I'm having this correspondence with witches. Isn't it funny? Ha ha ha. And, you know, I would laugh, you know. And then finally, I found a tape recorder that could play three quarters or whatever instead of 7.5. And I put the tape recorder, you know, I put the thing on the tape recorder and there was this ritual and it was called the Drawing Down of the Moon, which later became the title of the larger book that I've written called Drawing Down the Moon. And there was this couple and they were saying this invocation and it was incredibly beautiful. And there was Brahms in the background and they had English accents. So of course I was a total sucker, you know, and they were saying, you know, hear ye the words of the great goddess who was of old also called. And it was all those names I had used as a child. And then the woman in the ritual started speaking as the goddess. And I went, oh my heavens. She's an adult. She's in England. She's not in a mental hospital, you know, and she can do this. And if she can do this, I can allow that, whatever that was, out of that sort of deep place inside that I wasn't really willing to go to for years because I thought people would think I was crazy.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of how it all started.
We'll come back to this idea of spirituality and this idea that, you, as you say, it wasn't that you wanted to worship the goddesses, that you wanted to be them. I mean, there's a connection there to the story about vampires. But let's start sort of from the beginning of this part of the journey, the vampire part. Because you talk about in the book, you hadn't really been all that interested in vampires. But you kind of have this random encounter with the Twilight series. You're just sort of
I was at a conference and I needed a trashy novel for the plane. Yeah. And so I read the first novel on, you know, the way there and the second novel on the way back. And, you know, it probably wouldn't have gone anywhere. I mean, I got into it. I kind of got sucked in. Yeah. But I wasn't really, it wasn't a big deal in any way. And about, 7 days after I came back from this conference, my husband, who was the healthiest man on the planet, he had never smoked. He'd never even taken any drugs in the 60s, He was like, had no genetic things that we knew of. And suddenly he got diagnosed with terminal stomach cancer told that, he had less than a year to live and put on various chemotherapies. And it was just like this unbelievable shock. And so there I was. I started working just part-time and sitting by his bedside. And as I was sitting by his bedside, I just started obsessively reading vampire novels. Mm. And I think at the beginning, it was a kind of, I guess I wanted to live long and I wanted him to live long and I didn't want us to die and I didn't want him to die. And so at the beginning, it was really this kind of, they were a fantasy and I found myself fantasizing that we were vampires and that I was a vampire and so forth. And so in the beginning, it was all about that. And then about 4 months into this, as I'm sitting down and reading all this and also watching all those things I'd never watched, like I'd never watched Buffy. And so I watched every episode of Buffy and all of that stuff. And as I'm doing this, I'm suddenly saying, okay, mortality is interesting and immortality is interesting, but that doesn't explain why Hollywood spent, $7 billion in the last couple of years on vampire movies. And, something else is going on. And so that led to the beginning of this long exploration. And I would say that the things that really hit me, and we can go to each one of them, the first thing that really hit me was power.
Right.
Was that underneath, everybody said, oh, it's all about sex. It's all about teens and sex. And then I said, well, it can't be quite that because all the classic vampire novels like Anne Rice and Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough, they're erotic and sensual, but there's no intercourse in them whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So it's not sex as we commonly think of it. And it's certainly not sex like some of the modern romance vampire novels are. So it's something else is going on. And then I had this weird thought that everybody thinks rape at first is about sex, but underneath it's about power.
Yeah.
And so I started to explore and I noticed and I also thought, wow, teens have the most clear-eyed view of power because they see its abuses. They're under the thumb of school and parents and all of that. And so they're really dealing with power and abuse of power issues. And so that may be one of the reasons why they're really attracted to vampires. And during that, while I was doing that, several things happened. One was I met this wonderful Quaker professor at the University of the Pacific. And she teaches a lot of courses. And, she teaches Jane Austen and she teaches the literature of war. But she also teaches a vampire in fiction and film course. And she said to me, every good vampire film and every good vampire book are all about the same question. And that question is, if you are the top of the food chain, like vampires are,
right,
do you treat human beings like cattle or do you have to treat them with respect because you were once human? And she said, that question is not different than the question we ask ourselves or aren't willing to ask ourselves every day, which is, if I have more money than you, if I have more status than you, if I have more power than you, how do I treat you? Does might make right? It's a great Quaker question.
Yeah.
So I came back from that and then I started looking at Buffy, which has a lot of power things, and I looked at that. And then I had this moment where I had two moments. One was I started looking at vampires in history, and I realized that all the people who've written about sort of vampires and power, that it was like this huge thread that Marx and Engels had used vampires in this sort of predatory way as, you know, the capitalist system, and that Voltaire way back in 17-whatever had written in his philosophical dictionary all this stuff about vampires being – there weren't real vampires. But if you look at the people who live in really great houses and, you know, who are rifling the public essentially, they're, you know, they're the vampires. And then I looked at the financial crisis, and I saw all these people writing about vampires as part of the financial crisis. You know, the Glass-Steagall Act is a ray of sunshine that makes the vampires of Wall Street scream, you know. Yeah. And then, you know, and I noticed that Occupy Wall Street was using vampires as a symbol. So that was really fascinating. And then I wrote Anne Rice. I sort of said, okay, Anne Rice, what do you think? Why do you think vampires have such power and traction in our culture? And Anne Rice wrote me back. And she said, at first she said, oh, it's not, you know, the vampire is the outsider and teens are attracted, blah, blah, blah. But she said, for teens, let's see if I can get this quote correct. She said, for teens, they are attracted to vampires because they are desperately seeking a noble path through the hideous passage that Western culture has set up for them. And I went, whoa. What does that mean? And then I started thinking, I went back to Twilight. And in Twilight, the Cullens, who are the vampire family, have to do high school over and over again. They have to do high school like 5 times by the time the book starts. Can you imagine going to your senior prom 5 times? Can you imagine that, what that would be like? It would be a real horror story, you know? And so I realized that teens have to traverse corporate culture, jock culture, the, you know, bullying, the again, their parents, college pressures of getting into college grades, all that stuff. And that vampires in some way are this, you know, this way of escaping in some way into another reality where you aren't really dealing with this, where you're a powerful being, you have all kinds of various powers. And I came across all these wonderful books in which – these are nonfiction books – in which people were saying that, you know, that teens and others – and us and all the people who are interested in vampires don't want to – they really don't want to – have sex with vampires or even meet them. They want to be them.
Yeah.
And to be them, yes. And so, you know, for example, Gordon Melton, who wrote the biggest encyclopedia about vampires, the Book of the Undead, he has a whole section of how he was growing up in an evangelical family and how in that family he, you know, he realized there was a difference between evil and dark, and how he would go to sleep and, wish that he was a vampire. And Kathleen Ramsland, the biographer of Anne Rice, you know, has this passage in one of her books in which she says, I used to tell people I was 403 years old. And when I went to sleep, I would cross my arms over my heart and just hope I would wake up as a vampire, you know? So there were all these fascinating, you know, things about vampires and power. And so that was the first thing. But then I said, but that doesn't completely explain it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we have to go to something else.
Yeah, I want to talk about some of those things, too. Let me say something about history, because you write about this, you know, our modern idea of the vampire. You've talked about came at that. It really, it came at the same moment that gave us the story of Frankenstein. This
right.
was in that Swiss chalet in 1816, which is a way of sort of explaining. To talk a little bit about that, this John Polidor story, Vampire, which is the first one in the English language.
In the English language. Yeah. Well, it was written, you know, in the same chalet. It began on the same weekend that Mary Shelley started Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And I think I have to backtrack a little and say that one of the most interesting moments in my research was coming across a book by Nina Auerbach called Our Vampires Ourselves.
Yeah.
And this was written about 15, 20 years ago. I forget exactly when. And she has a line in it which she says, every age embraces the vampire it needs. And so One of the most obvious examples would be Dracula, 1897. England had some of the largest ports in the world. There was a fear of immigration. There was a fear of disease coming in. So here you have this Eastern European monster bringing dirt from a foreign land, the perfect sort of symbol of those fears and concerns of that moment. 1816, you have Polidori writing Vampire. And, you know, you could say that what was going on at that moment? Well, there was definitely Frankenstein is certainly a symbol of this fear of science playing God and what happens when we don't have sort of God to do this and suddenly science is going all out of control. You know, in the 80s, you can even think that some vampire novels in the 80s were a vampirism was a disease right at the height of the AIDS epidemic. Yeah. So, you know, you can sort of argue that vampires represented the fears and concerns of every single time. And as a matter of fact, there's a really funny book called The Dead Travel Fast by Eric Newsom, the guy who's actually a person at NPR in Washington. And he wrote this book called The Dead Travel Fast. And one of the things he says is, if you want to understand a culture, just look at their vampires.
It's interesting because you say they were this was interesting when the wall, the Berlin Wall came tumbling down. The stories of vampires kind of subsided for a time because there was a lot less fear. And I guess this fear about the Soviet Union, you mentioned The Hunger, for example, Whitley Strieber's book, was kind of a reflection of those kind of fears we had in the 80s, for example, I guess.
Yes. On the other hand, the interesting thing about Strieber, about Whitley Strieber, is his vampires all fit within science fiction because none of them are demonic. They're all a separate species. And there's a whole slew of vampire stories in which they are just a different species that has different needs than us. There's even a wonderful short story called Food to All Flesh, I think it is, by Zena Henderson. And it's just this wonderful, wonderful story of a spaceship comes down and this priest is in his garden and he suddenly says, oh, I'm the first person. I'm the first person to actually see a spaceship come down. And this creature comes out with he realizes it's her with all her little babies and he tries to give her food. And so he gives her this and she regurgitates it and gives her this and gives it, you know, this goes on all day. And then he goes to sleep. And the next day they're all very hungry. All the babies are a little crying and he gives more stuff and they regurgitate it and more stuff and more stuff and more stuff. And finally, one of the little babies goes onto his arm and bites him and falls right to sleep. And at that moment, the mother, the host, the mother in the spaceship, looks at him for a long, long time, takes her babies, gets back in the ship, and goes away.
Margot Adler, her book is Vampires Are Us, Understanding Our Love Affair with the Immortal Dark Side. She's joining us today from Boulder. She's attending a conference there. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with NPR correspondent Margot Adler. We're talking about her new book, Vampires Are Us, Understanding Our Love Affair with the Immortal Dark Side. Margot Adler, so how did you go about it? You started reading books and you read one and then you read another one. Was there ever a method to it? Or did you just sort of, did you start putting them in categories and figure you wanted to read this and this? I mean, how did it work?
Well, one book sort of led to the other, but I did keep a I basically summarized every book I read.
Yeah.
That was number one. I did a definite summary of every. And I actually did an NPR piece at one point when I was just starting out.
Right.
And then I realized that also that all these books went into every genre. And that was one of the biggest surprises, because when people hear that I've read 270 vampire novels, they say, their first reaction is, there are 270
right.
vampire novels?
Right.
And actually, there are probably more than 6,000 short stories and novels about vampires in the English language. There actually was a bibliography in 2009 that had 5,000 listed. So there are a lot of them. But what was really fascinating to me was that they really fell into all kinds of, that almost every genre had its vampire version. So there are detective vampire novels and presidential vampire thrillers and romance novels and nerdy, teen, geeky, you know, like there's a book called Suck It Up, where the kid is 15 and has acne, and then he gets turned and is going to have acne for the rest of his life, you know.
Yeah.
And there are alternate histories, you know, Dracula's still alive and is working with the Nazis. There are all kinds of, you know, science fiction. It just goes on and on and on. And some of them are terrible.
Yeah.
And some of them are great. You know, George R.R. Martin has a book called Fever Dream, which is, you know, the guy of Game of Thrones. And it's a brilliant novel, a brilliant vampire novel. There are romance novels that are so bad, you want to throw them against the wall, you know, that are just, I mean, they're just, you know, repetitive sex scene after repetitive sex scene, you know, six of them, you know, with you know, sentences like, you know, he filled me, you know, and you
yeah.
want to just go, oh, my God, please, I do not want to read this. And then there are some really beautifully, beautifully written novels. So, yes, they're all different kinds. And so I started putting them into genres.
You said that there were only really 20 that were a complete waste of time, which seems surprising. Proportionally, they weren't as bad, I guess, weren't as bad as you figured.
Well, I may have a very high tolerance
yeah.
of junk,
yeah.
you know. So, you know, and I didn't read, when I would come across a series, you know, and it would be horrible, I wouldn't read any of the other ones, you know. I mean, I only kept on reading when there were series or trilogies or whatever if I liked the first one, you know. So,
I guess the big question is, you know, we talked about some of the fears that of another time. So let's talk a little bit about the fears, the concerns going on today, because you're saying one of those concerns is this struggle, and it's always been, but this struggle to be moral, despite your, you know, your vampire instincts, despite your persona, your identity. It's this conflict to want to be good, I guess.
Well, I mean, that was the surprising thing that I sort of figured out on a complete, just, you know, one day I just took all the most popular vampires on television and film in the last 20 years, you know, Angel and Spike and Buffy and Eric and Bill and True Blood and the Cullens. And I just went on and on and on. I had about 20 of these listed in a row. And I suddenly had this, oh, my heavens, they're all conflicted. They're all desperately struggling to be moral despite being predators. And they're not exactly like the vampires that went before. And, oh, my heavens. And then the sort of next thought was, that's exactly who we are now. We're desperately struggling to be moral despite being predators, but we're failing a lot, just as they're failing a lot. It's just that, you know, and this was a crazy thought I just had, you know, their predation is blood, and ours is really the planet. It's oil, it's fossil fuels, it's the way we live, et cetera. And so I suddenly had this view that we were, you know, in our own way, we were kind of them and they were us. And that's where I got the title, Vampires Are Us. And then I started saying, well, when did this conflicted vampire appear? And my first thought was, oh, it goes back to Anne Rice. And certainly, you know, all the vampires in her books, at least several of them, are very, very deeply conflicted. And then I thought, well, maybe it goes back even further than that. And I suddenly started thinking about Barnabas in Dark Shadows. Mm-hmm. And he came around 1967, but he wasn't even called a vampire. And he didn't really until later in the thing. And I suddenly said, well, what was going on in 1967, 68, and I suddenly had this I had been reading, in a different time, some stuff. Rusty Schweiker, the astronaut, is a friend of mine. And suddenly I had this kind of, oh, it's when we first saw the Earth from space. And that changed us. That totally changed who we are and the way we thought about ourselves. And I started thinking, wow, when did that happen? Well, 1968 was the first color photo of the Earth from space in Apollo 8. And then in 72, there was the blue marble Earth, that incredible picture, which is probably the most reproduced picture in the world at this point. And everybody started seeing us as vulnerable, as small, as this beautiful blue little planet in darkness. And suddenly we were, oh my heavens, you know, we were not the big thing that we thought we were. We were not in the center of the universe. We were, in fact, very vulnerable. And in fact, we were, it was complicated. It was really complicated who we were, you know.
You include an essay in the book by the poet Archibald MacLeish, which was in the New York Times that it was included. It was when the astronauts were still on their mission. This was December of 1968.
Right. It was before the photograph.
Yeah.
It was before the photograph.
Yeah.
It was almost miraculous.
Yeah. Read this section for us, will you?
Yeah. Yeah. Let me find it. Okay. Here it is. The medieval notion of the Earth put man at the center of everything. The nuclear notion of the Earth put him nowhere, beyond the range of reason even, lost in absurdity and war. The latest notion may have other consequences, formed as it was in the minds of heroic voyagers who were also men. It may remake our image of mankind. To see the Earth as it truly is, small and blue and beautiful, in that eternal silence where it floats, is to see ourselves as riders on the earth together, brothers on that bright loveliness in the eternal cold, brothers who know now they are truly brothers. Now, I have to say that I love that quote, but I think it's too optimistic. And I actually think that what this vision did, I mean, it really led to a lot of things. The first Earth Day came literally 2 years after that vision, after we saw the Earth from space in 1970. But I think, in a way, it was a much darker vision. And it was, I want to find, if I can, Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
Who we all should know about now that Neil deGrasse Tyson is doing Cosmos and sort of doing a hagiography to Sagan. But he basically had this book called the Pale Blue Dot.
Right.
And he writes, our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. There is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. And I think that's the real quote. I mean, the quote is, we are responsible. We are complicit. We are the people who have to get this together. And it, you know, one of the things I was fascinated by was that Stuart Brand, who wrote the whole Earth catalog, when he wrote it in right around that time, 70, he had this really optimistic quote at the beginning of the catalog, which was, we are as gods and might as well get good at it. And in his most recent book, which is something like, it's Whole Earth something, I forget the title of it, he suddenly says, we are as gods and have, in capitals, have to get good at it. So there's suddenly a certain desperation that we're not going to get it together. And I think that's the same guilt that I was seeing, these kind of conflicted guilt that I was seeing in these vampires, was kind of the conflicted guilt that so many of us have about the way we live on the earth.
What was it Whitley Strieber said? The earth is our prey.
The earth is our prey. Yeah, I called him up and I said, am I crazy?
Yeah.
Am I totally crazy to think this? And he said, no, our prey is the planet. That's what he said. Our prey is the planet.
You say that when you began all of this, that it at first it didn't really occur to you that this was not just about the earth, but it was also about spirituality, that you had left religion out of the picture, which is strange given your lifelong interest in spirituality and paganism and all those kinds of things. But at what point did it strike you that this was also spiritual, this question?
Well, I think quite truthfully, it came through another book when I was reading this book called Gothica by Victoria Nelson. And she has a whole section on Twilight and also on action figures and how in some way they are part of a kind of spirituality for people who are in our culture and don't really have a spirituality. And she has this great quote at the end. You know, actually, I end my big essay on vampires with this quote, but she puts it very, very quickly, like in the first few pages of her book. And it's a quote that at first, when I read it, I thought was Philip K. Dick, and I went running around to find Philip K. Dick. It wasn't. It was her. But it was based on a kind of view of what Philip K. Dick might have said. And it was kind of it was basically a view about how we have essentially had to need a kind of spirituality when spirituality has been taken from us. And the quote is, when the divine has been exiled from the table of serious art and intellectual discussion for well over a century, you have to look for it in what elite culture thinks of as the trash. And I think, and so she was saying that a lot of action figures, a lot of, you know, whether you're talking about Superman, whether you're talking about whatever else, action comics, and she even has a chapter on Twilight in which she shows that Bella, far from being, you know, is in a way a goddess that is reborn, yeah, and is much more powerful than Edward. And so it was just fascinating to read this book and start thinking, because I had kind of bought in, well, vampires can't be spiritual because there's so much negativity associated with them, yeah, you know, yeah, and, you know, they're bloodsuckers and stuff. And how can you say they're spiritual? But the more I thought about it, and the more I thought about us, most people sort of growing up in this kind of secular culture, where they really aren't thinking about spiritual issues and they're sort of coming in through the back door. And, you know, and maybe that's why only 20 of these books were horrible to me, because right, there was kind of some little diamond in the rough in all of them that was speaking to me, even though, you know, a lot of it was, you know, with the dregs of nothing, you know.
You know, it's interesting when the spirituality part, there are these kind of two, they're not conflicting ideas about Stephanie Meyer and how her Mormonism might be reflected in her books.
Oh, yeah.
But you talk about how, at one section in the book, that if there's a Mormon dimension to Stephanie Meyer's books, you think that, or at least you thought, that it was about her, this longing for and this belief in these large extended families and this sense of spirituality, whereas—
And sense of community,
And community,
yes,
right. Whereas Nelson, Victoria Nelson, saw something else, or maybe it's similar, but she says it's Meyer's Mormon worldview that if you live the right life, as you put it in the book, you will die and become a kind of god. I thought that was really interesting.
Yes, remember, you guys, like the Book of Mormon, like you get your own planet, you know, right? And yeah, there is a lot of stuff about that. Now, my first, you know, I started out with Twilight taking the typical feminist view, you know, it's all about repressed sexuality, mm-hmm, and, you know, Edward is a stalker and stuff like that. And the more I thought about it, I thought Bella is an only child, just like me, and she is an only child of divorce, just like me, and she basically, you know, has not a very exciting family life, and she has no good discussions with her family. You know, she's with her father, he's a cop, he's a good guy, but there's nothing there. Yeah. She's, you know, her mother's in Florida, you know, with a minor league baseball player, there's nothing going on there. And here are these two huge extended families, one of which is tribal and Native American with all this lore and all this stuff. And then there's this other super educated, you know, Mozart coming out of the speakers, you know, degrees on the wall, you know, Cullen family. But both are better choices than her own. So my first thought was, oh, that's the Mormon idea that you have large families. But then when I read, you know, Nelson, I was very intrigued by her notion that Bella essentially dies and is reborn, and she is reborn as a god. And, you know, by doing things right, you sort of get to live the life that you really want. And I was very, you know, the chapter that Victoria Nelson actually writes is something called, a God Reborn, something like a God Reborn. And it has a picture of Edward Cullen looking like a kind of tantric Tibetan, God,
yeah.
Which of course, all that sparkle, that silly sparkle stuff.
So it's interesting. You've talked about this. The question, of course, becomes what's next? What's the next version of vampire? One of the things you've said is that we're starting to see stories where vampires are not beside the point, but they're not the central character, and their predicament isn't the central thing. And I wonder, what does that mean about what we're worried about?
Oh, I have no clue, but there are wonderful books out there in which there's a vampire character, but they're also, I'm thinking of A Discovery of Witches, for example, which is this magnificent book by Deborah Harkness, who is a professor of history and the history of science at, I think, USC, and manages to combine in a sprawling novel genetics, hard science, alchemy, magic, witches, a vampire, and she manages to do all of that in a novel, which is pretty interesting, I do think that in the novels we are seeing, where we see different species of kind of fantasy characters, like we see werewolves and vampires and so forth, mm-hmm. that it's the vampires that are dealing with the power reality. That, I'm thinking of there's a series of novels, the Kitty Norville novels, in which she's a werewolf. But all the power stuff comes from the vampires. And it kind of makes sense, because if you're going to live 200 years or more, you're going to spend a lot of time moving your chess pieces, it's going to be much more interesting to sort of do strategy. You're going to need something like that for your life. I mean, imagine Kevin Spacey living 200 years. I can't even imagine next week,
I wanted to ask you finally, earlier we were talking about vampires and how they were an expression of our sense of mortality. Mm-hmm. So how has this vampire journey helped you with your own journey? And we should say, you have cancer, you're dealing with cancer right now, you're healthy,
correct.
But how was that put, if it has, perspective on what you're going through now?
I think that when the chips are down, it hasn't helped that much.
Yeah.
Way down deep, the whole cancer experience has been very surreal for me, because I have a kind that's there's not a lot of stuff out there for. It's not well funded. It's not this. It's fairly rare. The national stats are hideous, and yet I feel incredibly healthy. And so it's like, do I really have cancer? I don't really even believe it half the time. So vampires have been a fun way to kind of get out of myself and to fantasize and I've had my own vampire fantasies. But in the end, I think, it was wonderful for a time, and it really helped me through my husband's illness, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not so sure it has that many key lessons for mine.
Margot Adler, the book is Vampires Are Us, Understanding Our Love Affair with the Immortal Dark Side. She joined us from member station KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. Margo, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our thanks to Taylor Almond, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.